Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keen, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. Joining us right now, Marilyn Watson, head of global fundamental fixed income strategy at BlackRock. Long ago and far away, she was head of global fundamental strategy for the Bank of England. We're thrilled that she could join us this morning. You have been in the halls of the Bank of England. Mm-hmm. How do you distill the chaos in England and also at their central bank?
Well, I think it's a combination of obviously the high inflation, the Bank of England raising rates, then the new government and the very poor communication around the mini budget that they announced. And I think that really completely took investors unawares. There was no sign of how, they were going to cut expenditure along with the cut in taxation. And I think it just added, on top of Brexit, on top of, the deep issues we're seeing in terms of economic activity in the UK, I think it just created, a lot of, carnage, essentially, in the gilt market for a time.
Big time. Tom, when you learn to ride a bicycle in the US, they're called stabilisers.
We call them training wheels.
Training wheels. Stabilisers in the UK. Yeah, very good. Just so everyone knows what I'm about to say. Is this bond market going to struggle without stabilisers, like the Bank of England gilt market operation when it expires in the middle of October?
So I think the Bank of England have already signalled, with the temporary, measures that they announced, I think the Bank of England is keenly aware that they want to keep the market stable. So they may, in fact, need to do a little bit more. I think at the moment, they're sort of treading a very fine line. The Bank of England, have a very, very measured approach to monetary policy. Every step that they take, is very, very finely nuanced. They assume essentially any tweaks that they make to the monetary policy won't be seen the full effects until at least 18 months out. So they're trying to adjust policy for a longer term trajectory, and yet they're dealing with a very volatile market right now. So I think the Bank of England is obviously incredibly keenly watching what's happening, and I think they will be prepared to do more if they do feel the need to keep the market stable. But I think it's also a global phenomenon. I mean, we've seen volatility across all asset markets. We're seeing across, all sovereign bond markets. So we're seeing, volatility here in the US. We're seeing it in Europe and elsewhere as well. So it's not just a UK phenomenon. But I do think in light of the fact that, we have issues that are global in terms of activity, issues specific to the UK, and then the fact that many central banks are obviously draining liquidity from the system at a time when inflation is high. I think it's just a confluence of many things, and it's being exacerbated in the UK.
Which raises this issue of stabilizers or training wheels for other central banks in terms of quantitative easing, yes, not quantitative tightening. Are you expecting a lot of central banks to fail at their attempts of quantitative tightening and end up actually having to buy bonds selectively on the long end, try to control some of the moves that they're seeing?
Yeah, so that's a, I think it's a very good question. And I think it we've never been in this environment before where we have had so many central banks that came away from positions of such loose monetary policy. They've had these massive bank balance sheets. They've had these huge QE programs. Rates have been incredibly loose. And we've never had a starting position where they're starting to tighten, you know, from these incredibly low levels, given how high inflation is as well. And so I think it does remain to be seen. I think here in the US, I think the path is pretty well laid out in terms of QT. It's already in progress. I think in the UK and also maybe in Europe as well, it remains to be seen. I think in, you know, in Europe, we do expect in the ECB to continue to raise rates the next two meetings. But in terms of reducing its overall, you know, bank balance and in terms of QT, it's still a little bit unknown when you have the asset purchase program on the one hand, you have the PEP program on the other hand, and it's a fine balance that they are trying to, you know, juggle.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, right now there's a lot of discussion about R*. I'm not going to get into the jargon. I don't want to do that. It's sort of, I know, I feel everyone just rolling their eyes as I say that.
I was smiling. But, Tom's yeah. furious.
but I am curious whether you have in your mind a level at which longer term yields could rise before the financial stability risks become more pressing than the inflation ones.
I think it's not just the level to which they rise. It's also the speed with which they do that. And so we don't have a certain level that we're currently looking at where we think we'll be overly concerned, and we don't think they're going to get to extreme levels. But we do think if the volatility increases and you see a dramatic shift, either because the economy is much worse than we expect, or because of other factors we don't know. But I think half of it is actually the speed and also how the curve reacts. It's not just the end point.
Marilyn, just final question. Just take a step back from all of this. Can you tell us how much the world has changed for you, Rick, for Bob, for the whole of the team, with rates where they are now? And are you looking at this world as maybe something that we have to live with for a while, that Fed funds, the risk-free asset, sticks around 3.50 to 4% and credit is hanging out at these levels?
That's right. I mean, the world has changed completely from a year ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. But actually, it gives us a lot more optimism now in terms of fixed income actually giving you a decent yield. I mean, obviously, we're relatively cautious in this environment, but fixed income now is really, I think, you know, a very decent, good asset class. Once again, you can get the decent return with little risk at the moment if you're in the front end with low duration. So I think for the long term and going into next year, then I think there are a huge number of opportunities in fixed income that we haven't seen for such a long time. So I think in terms of, you know, the team and fixed income investors in general, I think this is a far better environment going forward than we've seen for such a long time.
Do you think we can break out into this environment, a new equilibrium, a new normal on a sustainable basis? Do you get the feeling we can? We get a ton of pushback around the table that we just can't live with these levels of interest rates. Do you think we can?
Well, we've seen it in the past. We've certainly seen interest rates much higher than this in the past. And I certainly think we can live with interest rates being much higher. And I think to a certain extent, to get back to a healthy financial environment, you know, I think to have rates a little bit higher, I think, you know, is beneficial for a lot of different businesses. So I think it's certainly possible to get to a sustainable level that is beneficial for the economy.
The world has changed, that's for sure.
Yes.
Marilyn, thank you. Awesome to catch up. Marilyn Watson of BlackRock.
Stephen Shurk. He's principal at the Shurk Group. We protect the copyright of all our guests. Get his magnificent statement on the American distillate and oil economy from the Shurk Group. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us this morning. The simple question is, what does OPEC Plus mean to a gallon of gas? But far more than that is the nuance. How does OPEC Plus's decision impinge on the many distillates that we take from a barrel of oil?
Yeah, absolutely. OPEC's only influence over the market, Tom, is the price of crude oil by constricting the production or increasing the production thereof. So obviously, with the move they've made now, or the announcement they made yesterday of taking 2 million barrels off the market, clearly we're looking at fewer barrels on the market as we go into the fourth quarter. Now, I want to be clear here. OPEC made the announcement of a 2 million barrel cut, but OPEC is already, its 13 members, and I want to add, four of which are in sub-Saharan Africa, are struggling to maintain their current quotas. So by announcing a 2 million barrel cut, given what OPEC is actually putting onto the market now, the cut will amount to only 750 to 800,000 barrels a day, which is still not an insignificant number. And therefore, it has the potential for an impact on oil prices. Now, we don't consume oil, right? We consume the derivatives of oil, gasoline, jet fuel, diesel fuel, so forth. What we've seen here now, to answer your question, Tom, on the U.S. East Coast is our refinery capacity has been slashed by more than half over the past 10 years. We simply don't have the ability to turn what crude oil there is out there into what we need, into everything we need. Now, Thomas Sowell statement on economics is scarcity. We cannot produce everything that everybody wants. That is the current situation when it comes to oil derivatives. We are producing what most people want the most, that is gasoline. And therefore, what refining capacity we do have left here in New York is geared towards maximizing gasoline production. The other derivatives, i.e. heating oil, which is also diesel fuel, jet fuel, that suffers. So as we look ahead to this heating season, 70% of the homes in this country that heat their homes with oil are located in the Mid-Atlantic, New England states. We are going into this winter with a thimble full of heating oil. We do not have, it is a dire situation. We're going to this winter. We don't have enough supply. It is going to be a very volatile and a very expensive
Lisa, winter. We can get the heating oil from Europe.
Well, yeah, that's going to be tricky, right? Because we're going to be trying to provide them with natural gas as well. But Stephen, to your point about refineries and capacities, given that there has been talk about releasing even more from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to lower gasoline prices, how much are we bumping up against the limits of refineries where even a release won't really make a difference in lowering prices further? And really, we're kind of out of bullets.
Exactly. Well, we never had the bullets, Lisa. The doubling down on a policy that has failed is stupidity on stilts. We have been trying to manipulate the price. We, being the White House, have been trying to manipulate the price of oil now for the past year. Over the last 52 weeks, we've dumped 200 million barrels of government-owned crude oil onto the commercial market. And what do we have to show for that 1 year later? In New York, heating oil prices are $1.46 a gallon higher, 30% higher than they were a year ago. So we can drain, and we're just about there with the SPR. Over the last 52 weeks, we've drained a third of our emergency supply of oil. So what does that mean? A year ago, we had 42 days worth of supply of crude oil sitting in the SPR. Today, we have 26 days left of capacity. That is the lowest level since 1983. Now, keep in mind, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is for emergencies. Imagine last week if Hurricane Ian did not go into Tampa, but instead went into Houston or New Orleans, i.e. the oil epicenter of North America. We simply are the least prepared ever for an emergency. And the only thing we have to show for that, Lisa, 1 year on, is a 30% increase in distillate costs. So threatening OPEC with, oh, we're just going to put more oil. We're just going to do what hasn't worked over the 52 weeks, and we're going to do more of that. That is not a threat. OPEC is laughing this off right now.
Stephen, it's the Strategic Midterm Reserve, according to a friend of ours. Okay, remember that. Stephen Shork of the Shork Group. Thank you, sir.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Neela Richardson, let's go there right now. Michael McKee, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate that this morning. Neela Richardson with us, chief economist at ADP. Neela, I want to cut to the chase and just simply say, in the new emphasis on tomorrow's jobs report, what are you and ADP focused on?
Well, good morning. I can't think of a better way to start that conversation with wages. It's all about wages. It's about how wages are driving or not driving an inflation. And that's what we're focused on. It pays to be a microeconomist in a macro world, because when you are, you look at things as a collective of decision makings from small to large firms. And what we're seeing is that timing has been a very important factor in the entire dynamics of the labor market. We are now starting to see more people, at least as according to the August report, enter the jobs market. And we saw a deceleration in wage gains growth for job changers. And I think that deceleration is notable.
Right.
We saw it across all firm sizes, because it means that switching jobs is not paying off quite as much as it did this summer. And that might reduce some of the pressure in terms of inflation.
What's the and ADP is wonderful at this. What's the character of the job market differential out there right now? Is it airline pilots? Is it bartenders? Who is the job sector that matters to Neela Richardson right now?
Well, it all matters, Tom. But I think where we are different points of rebounding, right? So the service sector was hardest hit. And so when you look at leisure and hospitality, that's important. When you talk about inflation, though, what's driving inflation is low pay, low wage, low skill jobs. And are we still going to see that bartender or that waitress? Bartenders actually can make pretty good money. Let's go lower skill. Are we going to see low-skilled, low-pay workers still see gains and acceleration in pay? That didn't happen during the 10 years of expansion leading up to the pandemic. Well, we see it after we get over this hump of getting really back to normal when it comes to jobs and getting inflation down. That's the concern, that low-pay workers won't see the pay gains in the future that they saw over the last year and a half or so.
Neela, given that backdrop, I'd love you to comment on what Michael McKee was talking about, that there is this expectation that the unemployment rate will rise, but just marginally. Right? It might peak out at 4.5%, still well below some of the peaks that we've seen in recent downturns. How quickly could that move away from the Fed based on what you're seeing in the micro data?
Well, let's start with the jolts, because I think that's important. That was a big number this week, to see a million fewer job postings. We at ADP actually think that postings peaked this spring, so we weren't surprised to see that decline. So that's the first indicator. The second, this timing issue is really prevalent. If more people are coming back to the labor market because they want and need to work, and yet firms are slowing hiring, that's what's going to happen. Going to cause the unemployment rate to increase. That denominator is really important. It's not the number of jobs created every month so much. It's the number of people entering the labor market right at a time when firms may be slowing hiring. So I'm really focused on the denominator of the unemployment rate.
We're looking at this hoping that we still manage to get some sort of softish landing, but even Fed officials are really pulling back from that kind of language. Neela, from what you're looking at, what kind of downturn are we looking at based on some of the rate increases that are expected and based on the pace of weakening, the pace of loosening of this labor market?
I think you're going to see it different angles. Maybe you could call it a downturn by a variety of cuts as opposed to one big stab. Sorry to be graphic in the morning. But you're seeing interest rate sensitive sectors starting to feel some weakness in construction and manufacturing. If we see inflation really hit pocketbooks and consumer spending, you might see consumer services take a bit of a hit as well. And so all those gains in leisure and hospitality that we've been touting might slow. Professional business services are vulnerable for structural reasons. As fewer people go back into the office, that might change the complexion of like office support jobs. So the economy structurally is also changing at the same time that we might see some downturn dynamics driven by monetary policy. And tracing that all out is very difficult to do.
Neela, always love listening to you. Thanks for coming on the show with us. Neela Richardson there of ADP.
This is a joy. CIBC World Markets, Capital Markets, I should say, out of Toronto is a wonderful, wonderful shop. I think of Benjamin Tall and his great work. Bipin Rai joins us right now, head of foreign exchange strategy there on Canada, but so much more on the time we live in, which is strong dollar. Bipin, I want to talk about the x-axis of the belief that the dollar is going to weaken. Everyone's been wrong, wrong, wrong. Is your dollar study short-term or to go to the British medium-term or long-term? Where on the x-axis are you studying when the dollar breaks?
We're probably looking at the medium to long-term. And if you want a specific gauge for how long to, or at least a way to calibrate that, I would say that potentially in the early to mid part of next year is potentially when we'll start looking towards the next U.S. growth story, potentially leading to a softening of the dollar on a sustained basis.
Well, it's a softening of the dollar on a sustained basis, but the question is, what does EM do along the way? Are you partitioning now developed economies from EM, or are they holistically the same against strong dollar?
No, you have to partition them. I mean, if you look at the way EM has traded this year, it's been relatively robust compared to the dollar and at least compared to other DMs. I mean, most of the stronger dollar story has really been concentrated amongst the DM currencies, predominantly the traditional funders like the euro and the yen, and also now of late against the sterling. I mean, we think that will migrate more towards a stronger dollar versus commodity currencies backdrop as we move forward. And that's predominantly due to the imbalances that have been built up in some of these commodity currency economies, including here in Canada, and of course, Australia and New Zealand as well.
So over the past couple of months, and I really mean couple, like a month and a half perhaps, we've seen a little bit more stability enter the market. We haven't seen the same kind of runaway dollar strengthening, and we've seen a little bit more stasis at much lower levels versus the dollar for the euro. Pound is its own story. How long do you expect to get this kind of stability as people game out what we already know, which is rate hikes on both sides of the Atlantic?
Yeah. So if we're talking about stability in the dollar, we really need to delineate against what we expect the stability to come from. If we're talking about the broad dollar gauge, say the DXY, which of course is more tilted towards a greater weighting on the euro, then yeah, maybe the stability lasts a little bit longer, because I do think that a lot of the sources of concern earlier, particularly with respect to energy security, you know what, they've been pushed a little bit further out. I don't want to say they're completely resolved, of course, because a lot of it now depends on how serious the demand situation will be. And for that, you know, we need to really look at the weather reports or at least see what the weather looks like and how cold it is in the Eurozone for this winter. So if we're migrating away from this sort of, you know, concern that the dollar is going to continue to appreciate against the euro and potentially the yen, of course, an intervention story there, you know, that doesn't mean that the dollar still can't appreciate against some of the other currencies. And, you know, I very much agree with, you know, some of the other, you know, rhetoric that's been espoused by some of the other guests, that we're going to look at a higher for longer story and not necessarily a scenario where central banks are entertaining cuts next year. If that's the case, then we got to look at where the situations are fragile and where, you know, the higher for longer story could potentially break things. And that, to me, is somewhat concerning, especially for Canada and Australia.
John, when do we just start to get a meteorologist on?
I asked that, didn't I?
Yeah, exactly.
We should.
I mean, at what point is this going to determine the trajectory for the euro? I mean, let's say it's a cold winter, Bipin. What are we looking at in terms of what the euro dollar should be?
Yeah, if it's a colder than expected winter and we see a much more serious draw on natural gas supplies, we're looking at potentially 90 cent euro dollar, I think, and maybe even sustained momentum below there. That's when you start worrying about whether or not security risks or at least natural gas security is enough, given what we have now. I mean, one of the key things that have really driven has really driven the euro lower this year is the fact that the largest economy in Europe, and of course Italy as well, both have had to reorient their energy story away from Russia. And again, that's a structural change. That's not something that you could really hope to address in 1 year or even 2 years.
Bipin Rai, thank you, sir, of CIBC Capital Markets.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.